Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The Wake Up Call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Yeehaw! Welcome, boys and girls. Thank you so much for tuning in. All that bluegrass stuff just makes you all happy and such, and then you sit down and listen to us, and you get all smart and stuff. Isn't fun how that works on Sunday mornings, especially on a nice Sunday morning, not quite yet 95 degrees. Thanks again, WNRN, and especially to the folks in Lovingston on the 94.7, although we give a shout-out to the Harrisonburg and the Lynchburg and the Richmond folks as well. Our guest today, world famous. Is that right yet, Bill?
In parts of my house, I'm world famous.
Bill Antholis, Managing Director of the Brookings Institution. That's up in Washington, D.C.?
It is indeed.
One of those think tanks.
Indeed.
Indeed. A new book out, Fast Forward, Ethics and Politics in the Age of Global Warming. So we will be talking about global warming, but we're going to throw a little bit about political ethics and whether or not that exists out there or where we can find it.
One of the great oxymorons.
Jumbo shrimp. So Bill Enthol was here with us today. Write down the phone number because I'm going to think folks are going to want to dial in, stretch out the muscles. 979-0919-1877-WNRN-ROCKS. That's the toll-free line for those of you in Lovingston and Richmond and such. Bill, let's start with some of the basic stuff. Brookings Institution, a think tank in Washington. Does that mean that you're conservative junk or liberal junk?
Well, we like to not try to split the uprights on this. The way that we think about things at Brookings is the way somebody once described us. This is the chief of staff for a Republican member of Congress who said that most think tanks in Washington are like the game show Jeopardy. They put an answer up on the board that they already know, and then they scramble to try to figure out what the question is and compete with one another. And then the person paused and they said, but Brookings is different. You know, when I see something from them, I think they actually started with a question and they didn't know where the answer was going to be. And for me, that was the greatest compliment somebody could have paid us. We're 94 years old. We turned 100 in 2016.
Really? Wow.
And, we were started during the, it's actually, there's a Charlottesville connection. We were started during the Woodrow Wilson presidency. When Woodrow Wilson reached out to a businessman named Robert Brookings, who didn't invent but helped mass manufacture and sell clothespins. But he developed this incredibly effective accounting system. And Woodrow Wilson wanted him to bring to government the same sort of precision and effectiveness in budgeting, accounting, and analysis that Robert Brookings had brought to business. So he came to Washington and he set us up as the Institute for Governmental Studies, and they added an economic component a few years later and an in-house team. We used to teach for years. That's why we're brookings.edu when you go to the website. But now we're a nonprofit, independent. Our core values are quality, independence, and impact. Think tank, we've got about 100 senior fellows, which are sort of the equivalent of tenured professors at universities, about 400 people total, and 5 research programs, foreign policy, governance studies, economic studies, global economy, and metropolitan studies.
And you're a Charlottesville man yourself.
I am. I went to the University of Virginia. You and I graduated together in 1986.
Although I don't remember seeing you on the corner.
I had a lot more hair on the top of my head and a lot less hair on the front of it.
Yeah, and I probably had a few more brain cells for memory. All right, well, let's get into the topic at hand. This is Bill Antholis, Managing Director of the Brookings Institution, with a new book on global warming, as well as ethics and politics in the age of global warming. So many people are aware of the concept of global warming. There are those who believe in it, those who do not, that all the emissions in our current world are causing the Earth to get warmer on a regular basis, which will eventually melt the polar ice caps and flood the world and take over all our breathable air. And many people, I think, whether you, if you believe this concept, believe that America is the leading cause of global warming. Fair, not fair?
Fair.
And so I believe I read this in your book. America is the leading cause of global warming problem, so we must fix it.
Somewhat fair.
And I was talking with a friend about this who said, but China and India have more children to deal with for the future, so wouldn't they have a greater urge to fix it?
I once got accused by a friend in India of being, I wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal arguing for that actual thing, that because of India's population growth, they need to be part of the solution. And they said that I am now known in India as the man that thinks there are too many Indians. Look, this is a very Richard Gephardt once described climate change as the most fixing climate change as the most complicated political transaction in the history of mankind. If you think about it, just in the United States, we are the leading contributor historically to greenhouse gas emissions. When you put up carbon dioxide or methane or other greenhouse gas emissions, they stick in the atmosphere for 50 to 100 years.
So we have more cars and more cows than anybody else.
And more coal-fired power plants than anybody else. And we've been doing this for over 100 years. But India and China has caught up. They're now the leading emitter on an annual basis. And India is ranked fourth now behind U.S., China, and the European Union. And they're both looking to grow a lot. So the political combination that works for fixing it, we argue, is the United States and Europe have to act first, but China and India have to be right behind us. And the catch-22 is they're not going to act unless we act, but there are a lot of people in the United States that don't think it's fair for us to act unless they act. And so we sketch out in the book one way to try to cut that Gordian knot.
And now we're talking about global warming here, Bill Antholis, from the Brookings Institution and with a co-writer. Is that the proper term?
Yeah, co-author.
Co-author, thank you, for the book Fast Forward about global warming. And I don't expect that during the hour, and maybe you do, that to convince people who don't believe in global warming that it exists. My goal for the hour is to talk about the book while tossing out some facts and information. And one of the things that, even though I've seen Al Gore's movie and I read the articles in magazines and newspapers, we're only talking about a 3.6 degree of raised Fahrenheit before we've broken some barrier that will lead us to death and destruction.
Well, first, on your first point about whether or not we're going to convince anybody in this hour, we didn't think we were going to do it in a 125-page book, which its great virtue is its brevity, nor will we do it in the hour. But the one thing that I will say is if 4 out of 5 doctors told you that your child was running a fever, not that you were running a fever, but your child was running a fever, and something that you were doing, if you stopped doing it, could dramatically improve their chances for survival, you'd probably do it. And you'd ask about the fifth doctor and pursue every avenue of understanding why that course of action might not be the right one, but simply managing that risk is something that you would start doing. And that's what we argue for in the book. Now, let's go to the fever. You know, I'm hoping that you're sitting there staring at me with a 98.6 running through your veins. I think that's about where I am, although it's a little bit warm.
I think that the women in my life would ask.
If you went to about 99.6, you might be feeling a little funky. If you went to 100.6, 2 degrees Fahrenheit, you'd be feeling sort of really funky. And if you went to 101.6, 3 degrees Fahrenheit, now think about 102.2. That starts getting really, really uncomfortable. And at 104, you're likely to die. Now, the analogies between the human body and the globe are, you got to be pretty careful when you run on something like that. But one thing that we have already seen, we are already feeling the effects of climate change. In the Southeast, we have water shortages in a way that we didn't before. Some of that's water consumption, but a lot of that's that the water that falls comes in heavier storms and it runs off faster. And then we also have hotter, drier periods. in the Southwest, where I spend a fair amount of time. If you go to Lake Mead, that the Hoover Dam has created, the level of Lake Mead is down about 12%, and that's not just because they're using more water in Los Angeles. It's because the runoff from the Colorado River is smaller than it was 15 or 20 years ago. So these small temperature changes really do have real impacts.
But for as someone who doesn't believe or questions whether or not global warming believes, isn't the argument that, okay, come on, 3.6, it's one thing if your body temperature is supposed to be this certain level, but what is our globe temperature supposed to be? I mean, let's just, and I know this happens every day in this conversation for you. We were freezing to death in February, and it's 95 degrees, you know, this week right here in Charlottesville. So, you know, that's a heck of a lot more range than what the body can take. So how can it just be 3.6 degrees, you know, where we have to be so overly concerned?
Well, look, I'll say something that may surprise a lot of listeners and I think still surprise a lot of people in Washington. The truth is we don't really know and understand because the climate is such a complicated thing. But the basics that we do understand is when things get any little bit warmer, if you go from, you know, on a day that's 90 degrees to 93.6, water evaporates faster. And what that faster evaporation does is it speeds up the cycle of rainfall and then further evaporation. It makes for more intense storms. And then at the northern extremes, it actually happens faster. So what you see is melting of the global ice cap on either pole, as well as the third ice cap, the Himalayas and other glaciers around the world. And that melting can, if we go to 3.6 degrees, fundamentally change weather patterns. And that's the really scary thing. It'll affect our ability to grow food in the breadbasket in the United States and the breadbaskets in the Central Europe and the Ukraine and parts of China. And when you change that dramatically, that quickly, how the world interacts with the climate and the seasons, and particularly in producing agriculture, you have just dramatic shifts that we as a planet have not ever gone through before in that quick a period of time. We've had climatic variations over the eons, but nothing in the historic data tells us that we've done it as quickly as we are about to do it if we continue to emit fossil fuel emissions the way that we have.
So let's run on the assumption that global warming is a true, verified concern. Is global warming part of the cause for the political instability that we've had for a while? I mean, you can go back and people can make the argument we've always had political instability. But what political instability that we have had and are having can be associated directly to global warming? Is it out there?
I think it's hard, and I'm one who's very cautious about attributing any single weather event like Hurricane Katrina or last winter's snowstorms to global warming. There is an argument that says that actually in a slightly warmer world, and last winter's was actually, again, one of the warmest on record. What happens in a slightly warmer world is you speed up that hydrological cycle, so you get bigger storms. And so the argument would be that this bigger snowstorm that we had was because there was more moisture in the atmosphere, so when it happened to collide with a cold front, you just got much more snow than you normally would have. And as a generic matter, I think that's true, but I don't think we can blame last year's snowstorm. That said, in places like particularly Africa, Central Asia, where you have had more extensive heat waves, where you have growing desertification, where it's harder to grow stuff, and the Sahara Desert and other deserts creep into what once was arable land. Cutting down of natural resources that societies had depended on leads to political instability. So I won't say that the ongoing political crisis in Sudan was caused by global warming, but I do think that growing desertification, the collapse of agriculture there, collapse of agriculture in parts of Central America, which have been driven by drought and other climatic events, have led to instability. So what I do say is you are likely to see more resource strain in places of the world that aren't particularly stable politically.
Bill Antholis here from the Brookings Institution, a nonprofit public policy organization up in Washington, D.C. He's a co-author of a book on global warming. And there's a major section in the book that talks about President Obama in Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. It was the big event in 2009. I guess it's actually the biggest event talking environmentally in quite some time. Did anything happen? Because he ran on one of his principles was being an environmentally sound president, wanting to do things, looking ahead for the future, for the children of whatever country you're from, not just China and India, but also from the Americans and everywhere else. So what happened there? Because he's received a lot of grief for not following up on the things that he said he would do.
In the book, we call Copenhagen a useful disappointment. I was at Kyoto. I was one of the U.S. negotiators in Kyoto. We stayed up all night for several nights in a row in December of 1997. And looking back at that 12 years later, going into Copenhagen in December of 2009, a number of us started saying that the U.N. is not the place to negotiate big, complicated or treaties like this. I mean, if you think about it, let me take one step back to Richard Gephardt's quote. If you think about the way what he said, which is that climate change is the most complicated transaction in the history of mankind, political transaction, it's because in the U.S., doing what we need to do on climate change is about the size of the U.S. healthcare economy. Our energy economy is about 1/6 of our economy, as is healthcare. So if you think about doing that in 192 countries at the same time, I mean, how hard was it to do healthcare in the United States? That's how hard it's going to be to do energy. And then people have to do that in 192 other places. So that's the political challenge going into one of these UN negotiations. And for the last 20 years, certainly the last 12 years since Kyoto, the thought has been that we should do that with 192 countries and negotiate one big treaty. And what we came to realize over the last 12 years since Kyoto is it's just not the way to do it. And the reason it's not the way to do it is there's a half dozen countries that are going to try to stop action at all costs. These are oil exporting countries, places like Venezuela and Saudi Arabia and others that really don't want to see a global climate deal. So our view of Strobe Talbott and I are co-authors of Fast Forward. Our view is that the four biggest and most important countries on tackling climate change, the U.S., China, India, and the European Union, and we talk about the European Union as one country. We can talk about that some if you'd like. But those four places need to get together and hammer out an agreement. And at some level, that's what happened to Copenhagen. This was Obama's great victory. Even though the UN, the 192, the G192, if you will, didn't bless the Copenhagen Accord, the U.S., China, India, and the European Union, and a few other important countries like Brazil and Japan and Russia, did something called the Copenhagen Accord, where they agreed.
You say that Obama, that's one of his great.
Yeah, he hammered out.
Nobody
this
knows a damn thing about it.
Yeah.
Except, I mean, you with your expertise and in your field, but anybody who's listening, I mean, what percentage of the average person knows that that's what happened?
It was
whether you are for or against him.
Your question, I think, in many ways, is fairly typical of the questions asked about the Obama administration in general. Once again, they accomplished something. But for this president, who in his campaign did such a terrific job of mastering communications and selling things, has done an awful job selling his various accomplishments to the American people, whether it was the Recovery Act, the health care legislation, the financial legislation, or the Copenhagen Accord. They have not been particularly good salespeople of what I think was a signal accomplishment, which was moving away from the United Nations as the place to negotiate a global deal, and instead looking at it the way management consultants do. You solve 80% of the problem by focusing on 25% of it. If you look at just four countries that have, actually it's about just under half the world's population, about 60% of world GDP, about 60% of world emissions are just in those four countries. They have an agreement on how to move forward. Now, the real challenge is each of those four places adopting domestic measures that live up to their commitments at Copenhagen.
1121 here on the Wake Up Call. Bill Antholis here. He is co-author of a book regarding global warming, Fast Forward, Ethics and Politics in the Age of Global Warming. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Mostly sunny today, 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms in most of the listening area, 40%, however, over in the valley. Highs 90 to 95, a little cooler in the valley as well. Partly cloudy tonight with lows 70 to 75, and partly sunny tomorrow with a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms across the listening area, highs in the low 90s. Right now, it's pretty nice out there. Fair in the valley in 86, in Lynchburg 82, 89 in Richmond with a few clouds, Charlottesville 87.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
Oh, and let me thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support. You can find them here in Charlottesville and in Richmond. They have a selection of kayaks and canoes for summer getaways. You'll find canoes by Mad River, plus tandem, single, and sit-on-top kayaks from Wilderness Systems, along with stand-up paddle boats. That's Blue Ridge Mountain Sports in the Berkshire Shopping Center in Charlottesville on West Broad and the Chesterfield Town Center in Richmond. Online, brms.com. And we know there's lots of radio stations and other music sources out there, but only one that brings you the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. And we do that because of listeners like Stephanie Buckhart, Kathy Hinchy, and Matt Hodges, who supported us in the spring. It's also because of program underwriters like the ones you're hearing from, as well as others like Gearhart's Fine Chocolates and Integral Yoga. So stay tuned, tell a friend about the Wake Up Call and other programming you enjoy here on WNRN, and be sure to support us in the upcoming September Fund Drive, or you can head over to WNRN.org and see how you can help now. All right, back in action with our guest, Bill Antholis, as we talk about global warming. Bill, a little bit more. When I was going through the book, Fast Forward, there was this really interesting aspect or real event that happened in Copenhagen where President Obama was getting ready to leave and he wanted to have one last meeting and he couldn't find them. They kept putting things off. Tell that a little bit. I found that to be really go ahead.
Well, right before the break, we talked about the little-known success that happened at Copenhagen, which was getting China and India to sign up to commit themselves to cutting their greenhouse gases, which has never happened in an international context before. This was really the great accomplishment that's still somewhat unknown. One of the reasons we wrote the book, it's the beginning of a conversation with China and India that has to keep happening, and Obama was particularly successful in it. And the real challenge at Copenhagen was when he arrived, it was a bit of a mess. What you'd had for 2 weeks was a lot of stonewalling, particularly by a handful of countries that are oil exporters that didn't want anything to happen. They saw that over the year before, President Obama and Secretary Clinton had been going around the world, particularly with China and India, and edging them closer and closer to a deal. And they managed to sort of bollocks up the works for 2 weeks. And when Obama gets there, he's having a real hard time doing a deal, particularly with the Chinese. And in the book, we talk about how and why China was reluctant to act. Within China, there's a real division between those who want to stick with the way that things have been in the past, where they're building a new power plant every week, where their economy's booming, but so are their greenhouse gas emissions. They're now the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gases. But then there's a sort of more progressive side in China that both for understanding the environmental impacts that climate change will have on them, a growing desertification problem in the Chinese West, melting Himalayas, which ice pack, which, you know, China gets almost all of its water from the Himalayas. If you've ever seen a relief map of China, it's extraordinary how the country is dependent on that runoff. And the Chinese premier was sort of caught in the middle of this and actually was sort of closeted away in his office, unlike President Lula from Brazil and even some of the leading Indian negotiators. The Chinese were really sort of nowhere to be seen, and Obama couldn't find them. And finally, on the last day, when it looked like it was all going to fall apart, he and Secretary Clinton had heard that the Chinese had left and that the Indians had packed their bags and were about to leave. Then he heard that they were closeted away. And then he heard that the Chinese, Indians, and Brazilians and South Africans were meeting. And so the two of them figure out where this meeting is, and they make a beeline, and they essentially barge into the meeting together. And, you know, there is a deal on the table to be closed, and the Chinese and Indians are not wanting to do it. And President Obama sits down around the table with them, and over the course of the next 3 hours, hammers out this agreement. And it really is, I mean, if you think about, there have been G7 summit meetings now for going on 30 years. The UN every year has a big summit where all the leaders come together, but not a lot actually happens in terms of negotiating an agreement. And what President Obama did, which was so extraordinary, I mean, as I said before, I have my own criticisms of the Obama administration and how they've done a number of different things, including on domestic energy legislation where they did health care first. I would have liked to seen them do energy first. But over the course of 2 hours, he took these other world leaders and led them by the hand through an agreement, point by point, along with Secretary Clinton right there with him. And they came out of something where China and India, for the first time, have agreed to reduce their emissions, which is just an extraordinary accomplishment. And the Chinese and Indian leaders have been criticized quite roundly at home for roundly but wrongly, I say, for taking this step. It wouldn't have happened without President Obama spending the time and being there on the ground.
1127, we'll open up the phone lines. If you have a question or a comment you'd like to contribute to the conversation with Bill Antholis, Managing Director from the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and a Charlottesville resident, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN Rocks. Dial us up. I certainly have a full page of things here. You know, Bill, do we have the same ethical and political problems and issues, even if global warming doesn't exist? Isn't that just sort of an attachment to the problems that are out there rather than the cause?
There are a lot of the ethical issues that come up in global warming are pretty familiar. There's rich versus poor. There's rich versus poor within the United States, rich versus poor industrial countries and developing countries. And there's an intergenerational ethical issue of simply leaving the world a better place to future generations. What we think is so different about global warming, you know, in the last generation, my father's generation, my mother's generation, the philosopher Hannah Arendt, who I first read as an undergrad here at UVA, said that that was the first generation to do something in the history of mankind, to have two things. One, to have the ability to leave our planet through space flight. And the second, to the ability to destroy our planet through nuclear weapons. What we say in the book about global warming for this generation is that those of us alive are the first generation to know that we live in the age of global warming. We may also be the last generation to have any chance of doing something about it. Our forebears had the excuse of ignorance, and that is that they were contributing to global warming but didn't know it. Our descendants will have the excuse of helplessness. That is, they, unless we do something, they won't have an ability to change it other than to follow through on a path that we start. We don't have any excuse. And that for us is the difference of the ethical nature of this challenge, that we are at a moment in history where we can prevent this from becoming truly catastrophic or not. And I think the question for all of us, you know, I gave a talk to one of the graduating classes at UVA this year, the media and communications department. The generation starts with those that have just graduated college or just reached the age of citizenship and stretches out to my co-author who's 60 years old, going to be 70 in 26 or 64, going to be 70 in 2016 when Brookings reaches 100, its 100th birthday. And if you think about that 50-year expanse of humanity, we are the generation that has a chance to do something about it, and I, you know, we argue that we should.
Whether it's from your book, Fast Forward: Ethics and Politics in the Age of Global Warming, through magazine articles, newspaper articles, there's always the date of 2050. Mm-hmm. That's the date by which all these changes are negotiated that need to be done. And what I find this somewhat implausible number is that the goal was to reduce emissions by 80%. And granted, it's 40 years away, but 80%? And so how does that happen? What is on the table to be done to make that goal reachable?
Well, first, why the goal, and second, how it's reachable. The goal of 2050 is, as scientists have looked, and as I've said, as we said in the first segment of the show, there is still a huge amount of uncertainty about the science and great debates. But I think the core of scientific consensus is that the accumulation of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere as it proceeds to 2050 has a chance of raising the global temperature of a good chance of raising global temperature by 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And what would happen there is roughly at that point of temperature is that it would unleash a series of climatic changes, particularly having to do with the global ice caps and the importance of Gulf streams and how they affect our weather. And so greenhouse gases would accumulate by 2050 such that the weather comes up to the temperature comes up to 3.6 and it unleashes these dramatic changes. So that's why we pick that. That's why that date is focused. Right now, there are about 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. As we get to 450 parts per million, that's what they think would drive the temperature. The reason that I like to focus on that as a target for action and reducing greenhouse gases by 80% as opposed to earlier timeframes, which are a little bit easier to understand, perhaps, like in Kyoto, we were supposed to reduce our emissions by 7% by, 2010, this year. And we're up 15% as opposed to down 7%, or 2020. The reason 2050 is a better date is if you think about the mortgage in your house, if you buy a new house, you get a 30-year mortgage. And the assumption on a 30-year mortgage from the part of a bank is that most houses last about 30 years before they have to have some significant renovation. The capital stock for a coal-fired power plant, those things are expected to last about 30 to 40 years. Cars last 10 to 15 to 20 years. Most of the things that burn energy last between 20 and 40 years. And so if you hold out a date, 2050, and you say by 2050, we have to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, that gives us time to plan for and implement a new capital stock of energy-consuming vehicles, power plants, machinery, equipment, and ways of generating, not only generating power, but using power that have that goal in mind. And so if it's the reason that we can come to the U.S. politics, but right now a bill is still being debated in the U.S. Senate, or is about to be debated, which would at least cap emissions on power plants. The power utilities in the United States want this bill because they want the regulatory certainty when they make their capital investments for the next 40 years of where they have to go. They want to essentially lock in a set of regulations that they know won't change on a year-to-year basis, so they can start shifting, say, from coal-fired power plants to natural gas-fired power plants. Or if they're going to build a coal-fired power plant, they know now that by 2050 they have to capture the carbon and pump it someplace or do something with it.
11:34 on the wake-up call. Let me give a shout-out thank you to Sugar Snap. They offer gently used baby and kids items, including shoes and hats and nursing pillows. They also have maternity and nursing clothes. At Sugar Snap, you'll find cloth diapers and diaper bags and other locally made items. They have a kid-friendly play area, and you can become a fan of Sugar Snap on Facebook or Twitter. You can also find them online at sugarsnapconsignment.com. Bill Enthol was here as we talk about global warming. Bill, one of the things that I always talk about is the first paragraph reader. when you read the newspaper, for those who still do, it's you read the headline, you read the first paragraph, and unless it catches your attention, you move on. And so in this topic, I will put myself in that grouping. And as you talk about why the goal is 2050, for many people, I think you just kind of, you know, roll your eyes, shrug your shoulders and say, that's ridiculous. Or, well, you know, that's never going to happen because it's too far away to make people care. And you just explained that to me in what could have been a first paragraph of the article that would have drawn me in to read the rest of it. How do you handle this difficult topic and explaining it to others? Is this book designed for the guy on the street, mm-hmm. the woman, you know, who has to go to work every day and come home to deal with childcare?
It is. I mean, it's a short book. It's about 125 pages. It's the first in a series that we're starting at Brookings called the Focus Series, which are, I like to say about this book that it's Climate Change for Dummies and Climate Change for Moderates, written by two of both of them. That is that we came into it. My background is in political theory. Strobe was a diplomat and a Time magazine correspondent for many years before coming to Brookings. We wanted to write a book that was short, accessible, really understandable for the basic reader, that asked the hard questions about the science and the politics and gave a thoughtful, forward-looking answer in a way that that people could understand. This is what you were talking about, the first paragraph thing. It's something that friends of mine that were speechwriters, both for President Clinton and Secretary of State Christopher, who I worked for, eyes glaze over. This was an eyes glaze over issue. There are a bunch of them out there, and this was certainly one of them. The complexity of the science and the economics and the diplomacy and the ethics, there's just a lot there. And so we tried to tell it and put a narrative around it. It's not a analytic book. It's as much a short history of the political one step up, two step back process that's been going on to try to fix it. But with also this ethical overlay, we end, and this is sort of, we were going to the question of why we should focus on 2050. We end with a discussion about ethics, both political ethics and religious ethics on the issue. On the political ethics, we put it in the context of both conservative and liberal thinkers throughout history who have talked about intergenerational ethics. So Edmund Burke, the great British historian and political philosopher and member of parliament, who talked about, he didn't believe in social contract theory. He was responding to the U.S. Revolution and Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson. And he said that, you know, we have to understand politics as a contract, an unwritten contract between the dead, the living, and the yet to be born. But Thomas Jefferson himself, you know, who is a great, from personal experience, opponent of debt, also felt that we shouldn't leave unpaid debts to the next generation, even though he himself did a little bit of that. They had to do some mortgaging of Monticello, I think, in order to keep it in the family, and that didn't end up working out. And so there's this historical, ethical belief that the world should be left at least as good, if not a better place. The Boy Scout motto, don't leave any campsite worse to the next set of campers. That for us is the core. And then we quote pretty extensively a conservative senator, Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, who I have a great deal of respect for on a range of issues from military. And on this issue, he has really tried to be a trailblazer against the protests of some people in his own party. And he said that, I've been to enough college campuses to know that if you're 30 or younger, this climate issue is not a debate, it's a value. And that's for us where we came from. And then we close with a discussion of various religious leaders across the political spectrum in the United States, evangelicals to Catholics to Orthodox priests, but then also Muslim and Jewish and other religious leaders who have embraced action on this issue.
11:40 here on the Wake Up Call with Bill Antholis, Managing Director of the Brookings Institution and co-author of a book, Fast Forward, Ethics and Politics in the Age of Global Warming. It is 11:40 here on the Wake Up Call.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, this week the University of Virginia declared an energy emergency on Wednesday, July 7th, and responded by reducing energy use throughout the day. But Dominion Power disputes that energy emergency claim. So what's going on? State police recently pursued and caught a teenager driving over 100 miles per hour through city streets. Right or wrong for the high-speed chase. And a local 11-year-old girl wins big on Jeopardy. The Hook for Here to Go. And support for today's programming also comes from Ben Around Tattoos in downtown Waynesboro. They feature male and female tattoo artists. Ben Around Tattoos has thousands of designs available and can create work from a design that you provide. Ben Around Tattoos in downtown Waynesboro or at 701 West Main here in Charlottesville. For more information online, benaroundtattoos.com. And my man just walked in the studio. Drew Thompson will be here at noon for Les Temps Perdue, the best of 80s and 90s alternative, bands like The Replacements, The Smiths, and Psychedelic Furs. Brought to you in part by Orzo. And requests are always welcome. Plus, this week, today, Drew will have the 25th anniversary edition of REM's Fables of the Reconstruction to give away. And if you remember, you've got the DVD to go along with it. So tune in noon with Drew Thompson.
Has it been 25 years since Fables of the Reconstruction? Wow.
I know. It's little things like that that make me feel old. But fortunately, that's not true. I'm not old. Back with Bill Antholis. You know, one of the things we were talking about, I want to bring it up to a little more modern, something that for people with a current event, is how has the BP oil spill in Gulf of Mexico affected changes? Has it done anything to speed along the process or to bring in people who weren't normally involved into this? And what, if anything, has it done with global warming itself?
Well, I think the short answer is that the oil spill slowed, if not stopped, the push for legislation. And there was an effort by President Obama and many supporters of moving forward on comprehensive energy and climate legislation to use the oil spill to draw attention to how much and how dependent we were on fossil fuels. So in the president's Oval Office address, he made allusion at the end toward comprehensive energy and climate legislation and the need to do that. My own view is that when people were looking around for who was to blame, BP or their contractors or the federal government, at some level, look, we're all to blame for the oil spill. Any form of energy that we have, whether it's petroleum or coal or nuclear, comes with external consequences and causes and costs.
Wind turbines cause dead birds.
Wind turbines cause dead birds. Solar panels in the desert undermine a pristine view of the desert and potentially desert ecosystems. Whatever we do right now to generate energy has a cost and a consequence beyond what we pay at the pump. And so the argument that people were trying to make off the BP spill, supporters of the legislation, was, look, this is a moment to start addressing some of those costs and put a pure price for carbon, that is, the great externality. Forget about oil spills. The greater externality of burning petroleum is the carbon that gets thrown up in the atmosphere that causes global warming. That was the argument. My own sense is that by itself is not what's going to drive legislation forward. We need to continue to build public education and understanding about the risk that we take. Is it 100% risk? No. Is it an 80% risk? Yes. That continued greenhouse gas emissions are going to cause catastrophic global warming.
Well, not to change topic, but just as an example, it's just within the last week that I think legislation was made to hopefully resolve the problems that brought about the great economic downfall from behavior on Wall Street. And so that's been almost 2 years, I believe, since those things happened. And it seemed to have fallen by the wayside, except for the handful of people who kept it up. And many people, depending on your side of, you know, where you stand on the topic, have said, we don't need that. That's silly. And even those who fought for it in the beginning sort of dropped in and have now picked up another topic. Mm-hmm. And so where will we be in 2 years with the BP oil spill and where it affects our political or ethical decision making?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, look, there is a real effort now that they've gotten financial legislation behind them to focus the U.S. Senate on this. Remember, the House of Representatives a year ago, more than a year ago, passed comprehensive energy and climate legislation. And there were 7 Republican votes in the House. Now, that may not seem like a lot. Actually, 8 Republican votes in the House. It passed by 7 votes. 8 Republicans voting for something in a body of 435 people may not seem like a lot, but it was the high watermark on major legislation of Republican support for this. And the reason was, if you look at those 8 members, they weren't all moderates. Some of them saw that it would help wean us from foreign sources of petroleum. Some of them wanted clarity in offshore oil drilling, which would be part of that package. And then some of them also saw that climate change is an issue that shouldn't be a partisan one, and they embraced it. And I know from my own conversations with about another dozen other Republican members of Congress that they would like to do the same, but the party pressure on them to oppose it is pretty significant. So the Senate is now taking up similar legislation now that the financial services bill is done. And again, there are probably a half dozen Republican senators who would like to do something on this, but figuring out who those are and balancing those off against the number of Democratic senators from places like West Virginia and South Dakota who are heavily dependent on coal and fossil fuels, who will not vote for any kind of comprehensive energy and climate bill. That's a real political challenge, and it remains to be seen whether it'll get done this year, whether it then goes into the next Congress, which is likely to have much bigger Republican numbers, and what that might look like. It's a real question out there.
It is 11:47 on the Sunday morning wake-up call with Bill Antholis as we talk about global warming. All right, Bill, I got a two-part question here for you, and we're going to sort of do the Jeopardy thing where I ask...
Speed round.
So, you know, to follow up on that, what climate legislation is needed to, and that might be passed by Congress, because it seems like that may not all be the same.
Right.
But what's needed to make this, have this 2050, 80% emissions thing actually happen? At least here in the United States, let's focus on things that we have personal control over.
Well, so there's two schools of thought on this from people that do want to do something about it. One is the fastest, easiest, most effective way to do this is a carbon tax. It would apply to petroleum, you know, at the pump you'd see it, probably in the neighborhood, who knows exactly what it would be, but it would start out in the neighborhood of 10 cents a gallon and then would quickly move up.
So it wouldn't matter whether I was driving my Prius or my Hummer.
You're paying the tax.
I'm paying the tax based on how many gallons and how frequently
and,
I go.
Well, I mean, it does matter. You're still paying the tax, but if you're driving your Prius, you're just paying that tax a lot less frequently.
Okay.
But it also applies to coal. That also applies to natural gas, which emits some, but not as much CO2. It applies to anything that emits, and it applies across the economy. And the reason that people are in favor of doing a tax is that it is economically efficient to put a single price on carbon and have that ramp up between now and 2050 so that the tax becomes so exorbitant by 2050, nobody even thinks about using a fossil fuel. They're looking for some other form of energy.
I read something or heard the other day that it now costs over $11 for a pack of cigarettes in New York. And so it seems to me that that's a similar model that we're talking about here.
Right. I just came back from a vacation in Greece where amidst all their economic problems, they've raised the price on gasoline. It's $8 a gallon for gasoline in Greece right now. So people drive smaller cars. I saw a whole lot of hybrids there, the increasing number of Priuses. And it was fun to be in one over there where a Prius is one of the bigger cars if you drive around Athens. So that's one way to do it is a carbon tax. I actually see all kinds of benefits in it. I'm actually in favor of the now maligned cap and trade system. And the reason that I favor cap and trade is what a cap and trade does is doesn't regulate for the price of carbon or for the price of fossil fuels. It regulates for the amount of carbon that goes into the atmosphere. And then it creates a market to figure out who can reduce that carbon in the cheapest way possible. So right now we emit as a society just under 6 billion tons, gigatons, of CO2 a year. In a cap and trade system, you would see that number 6 go down year by year in small increments. So by 2050, we as a society would be reducing, we would be emitting 1 gigaton. And that's how you get 80% down. And then what happens is if you're a coal-fired power plant owner, you have to buy enough emission permits for the carbon that's released from your burning that coal. And every year, you're allowed to cash in a smaller number of permits. And so you either have to buy more permits from somebody else if you want to keep emitting, or figure out some way of reducing. And if you figure out some super smart way of reducing, you can sell your excess permits to somebody else and make money on the deal. And I like that for two reasons. One is that it gives a clear signal for where the carbon emissions have to be as opposed to where the price of the carbon is. And it lets people figure out the fastest, cheapest, easiest way to do it. And the second is it's truly market-based. I mean, you've created a new market for carbon. And they've done this in Europe, and they have had surprising success already.
And how are you punished? As a culture, as an American culture, and almost no one is able to reduce or chooses not to reduce, what's the punishment?
Essentially, the firms that, it's the coal-fired powered utilities, it's the oil companies who have to buy that permits. They pay for the permits, and then they pay a very significant penalty if they don't meet it. The way that we would see it at the gas pump is we would see higher prices, but the higher prices might or might not be higher if at the gas pump, Exxon and Shell come up with a non-carbon source of liquid fuel, or maybe they don't. And so the non-carbon source would be ethanol or other biofuels. If they don't, we could shift, and the price of gasoline goes up, you could shift to a car that you plug in to the power grid, where the power grid will increasingly shift to first natural gas and then to other alternative sources of energy. Or they'll take the carbon from a coal-fired plant and they'll pump it into the ground. And it would be cheaper as a car. Right now, if I'm thirsty, I have a choice. I can get a Coca-Cola, I can get a glass of orange juice, I can get water. If I drive a car, I have one choice. I buy petroleum. What we need to move to, I think, is a transportation economy where I have choices. I can buy a car that lives off oil. I can buy a car that lives off biodiesel. I can buy a car that lives off natural gas. Or I can buy a car that I plug into a socket at home and lives off the power grid.
And your vision isn't that we'll just become the Yankees and not care about what the luxury tax is and just keep paying it because it's easier and it's our preference to do it the way we've always done it?
I think the Yankees care about their luxury tax now. I mean, I think that that's one of the stories, right, is they've capped their spending at an enormous $200 million
a
year.
Nearly double what everyone else.
I'm a Yankees fan, so you're going into dangerous territory here.
Okay, so am I.
but I think actually what happens is some people are willing and capable of paying the tax. If you want to drive a Hummer, nobody's telling you you can't drive a Hummer. And you're willing to pay for it and pay more for it. And that's what happens in Europe. We saw a Hummer in Greece. We were all sort of shocked by it, but we were up in the mountains, and sure enough, somebody wants one there. But they're willing to pay that extra premium on their Hummer. We saw a lot more Fiat Pandas, which are, essentially the size of a smart car. And we saw the growing number of Priuses.
11:54 here on the Wake Up Call with Bill Antholis. He's the managing director of the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., co-author of a book on global warming, Fast Forward, Ethics and Politics in the Age of Global Warming. Let me thank Blue Ridge Graphics for allowing us to put on the program today. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street here in Charlottesville. They provide custom T-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746. Online, it's BRG T-shirts. Com. Just about 5 minutes left with Bill. Bill, it seems like much of the discussion comes back to actually doing what 4 out of 5 scientists say needs to be done. But it seems as though many of the people in power come from the age of the thermonuclear issues, where while that could also ruin our planet, that could happen during your lifetime. Mm-hmm. The vision was of the mushroom cloud and, I guess, the ruined landscape of Hiroshima and et cetera. All the things where you could walk out tomorrow and be involved in a thermonuclear war. And today you're asking those people in power to be concerned about global warming, which ain't going to happen to them tomorrow. Mm-hmm. How do you do that?
Well, it's again, one of the things that contributes to this being the most complex political transaction in the history of mankind. And the only one, I think the thermonuclear war is at the global level and even at the domestic political level to some degree, but not really as much. It's the great other global challenge of existential nature that the world figured out to do. But on the nuclear thing, the only thing that we had to do was not push the button. And on climate change, we push the button a little bit every day. And so the way that we talk about in the book is that there are sort of two ways of looking at execution. One is the guillotine, which focuses the concentration, focuses the mind to concentrate. There's a Chinese form of torture called slow slicing, which they take a very sharp razor and they cut a little bit of your finger off, a little bit more.
Good and grief.
And you start bleeding. And we're essentially bleeding now. You know, the challenge for this crisis is for political leaders to understand the pain of this challenge lined up against other very real pains that they're paying attention to. I don't criticize any political leader who's right now focused on the global economic and the U.S. domestic economic challenges that we have. They are enormous. People are out of work. We're looking at nearly 10% unemployment. And there's a lot of public fear about whether we're going for another dip on the recession and when people are going to get their jobs. This challenge is one of generations. And there are relatively inexpensive things that we can do now, like setting a long-term price on carbon. Or a long-term target for where carbon emissions have to go that can get us out of this mess without a whole lot more pain and slicing.
It just seems like this topic is the true test of political ethics. I mean, being concerned about the future and a future generation rather than the person who might or might not vote for you in November is truly checking someone's ethical plan.
Yeah, my kids are, I'm 45 years old. In the year 2050, my daughters will be 48 and 46. So they'll be my age. And one of the reasons that we sat down to write this book, and the book's dedicated to my kids and to Strobe's grandkids, was we wanted at the year 2050 for our kids to look back and understand whether or not our generation acted, and at a personal level, whether we, Strobe and I, contributed to the solution or just sat on the sidelines. And so my hope is that when my kids reach my age, they'll look back and think that that we helped leave the world at least as good shape, if not better shape, than we found it.
Bill, thank you so much for coming in today. Bill Antholis, Managing Director from the Brookings Institution. You can pick up, can you get your book on Amazon?
You can get it on Amazon or at the Brookings website. If you look at Fast Forward on Amazon, there's a book about confessions of a pornography screenwriter called Fast Forward. And I think the allusion is to fast forwarding through the films. But if you keep looking, you'll find us. And you can also get it on the Brookings website and hopefully at a bookstore near you.
And we'll put that link up to the Brookings website on the podcast, SeavillePodcast.com. Bill, thanks so much. I hope that we can have you back on again in the future.
Would be delighted to, and it's always great to be here in my hometown doing these things.
All right. Drew Thompson up next with Les Temps-Perdue. Adios.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.